Thank you very much. First and foremost, many thanks to Michele once again for giving me the opportunity to come to this place. I must say, I've been to many research institutes all over the world, but never to one like this with so many experts on quantum information and such a stimulating atmosphere. Anyway, the work, the title of my talk is Manipulating Entanglement, and I've got a hockey stick if you don't agree with me. And this is joint work with Gary Bowen. I will start with a little bit of an introduction meant towards people who don't exactly work on entanglement manipulation, and I hope the experts won't mind that. So, well, you all know that entanglement plays a crucial role in quantum information theory and is a novel resource which allows you to do tasks which you wouldn't have been able to do in the classical realm. And the fundamental property of entanglement, as you also know, is that it cannot be created by local operations and classical communications, for which I shall use the usual acronym of LOCC. However, one can transform one entangled state to another by LOCC alone, and this is called entanglement manipulation. Now, so if this is Alice and Bob, and they share an entangled state, and suppose Alice does local operations and communicates classically with Bob, so that as a result, the state gets changed to sigma AB. And we know that if E rho AB denotes the entanglement of the state rho AB, then because we are arriving at the state sigma AB from rho AB via LOCC, the entanglement of sigma AB is necessarily less than or equal to the entanglement of the original state, because entanglement cannot be created by LOCC. So an essential property of any quantity that is used to characterize entanglement is that it cannot be increased by LOCC alone. Now, for a bipartite pure state, as you all know, one such quantity is the Schmidt number, and psi AB is entangled if and only if its Schmidt number is greater than 1. But there is no such simple quantity characterizing the entanglement of an arbitrary bipartite state, rho AB. However, one can establish asymptotic measures of entanglement for any arbitrary bipartite state, be it pure or mixed, by considering suitable entanglement manipulations of it. So the first question is, why do we need entanglement manipulations? Now, this is to convert the entanglement of a state to a standard form or currency, in the words of John Preskill. So if you convert it in a standard form, then this allows you to compare the entanglement of two different entangled states. How does this work? What do I press? Sorry. Yeah. OK. And so you can compare the entanglements of two different entangled states. So what is the standard form or currency? To obtain it, we define the entanglement of a maximally entangled state of rank m, which also by torque will be denoted by this ket psi plus m. These are, of course, orthonormal basis vectors, to be given by log m, right? So this is what we usually do. And this then yields a benchmark against which to measure the entanglement of other states. So here the log is obviously taken to base 2, and which corresponds to assigning 1 EBIT of entanglement to a Bell state, for example. So asymptotic measures of entanglement of any arbitrary bipartite state rho are then obtained by considering entanglement manipulations, which would then convert multiple copies of rho via LOCC to, say, multiple Bell pairs, or vice versa. So, for example, what we can do is, this is what is usually done, you take n copies of your state and you convert it to, say, mn Bell pairs. So this is called entanglement distillation, or if rho is pure, it's called entanglement concentration, because you're going from something which is not maximally entangled to maximally entangled. Or equivalently, this corresponds to converting via LOCC n copies of your state to a maximally entangled state of rank mn, which is 2 to the mn, because such a maximally entangled state is unitarily equivalent to the state of mn Bell pairs. What about the vice versa? In the other direction, you could start with, say, mn prime Bell pairs, and then by LOCC convert them to n copies of your target state. And this is entanglement dilution because you're reducing the entanglement. So if you denote the density matrix of an arbitrary Bell pair by omega, then the above transformations can be written in this manner. Starting from n copies of rho, you go to mn copies of a Bell pair. So this is distillation. And mn prime copies to rho tends at n, that is dilution. Now, since entanglement cannot be increased by LOCC, what do we conclude? That the entanglement of this state must be less than or equal to the entanglement of the state it started from. And on the other hand, 2 says that the entanglement of rho tensor n is less than or equal to the entanglement of what we started on here. So if you put these two together, we conclude that the entanglement of n copies of rho must be less than, must satisfy these two bounds. And that's because by the benchmark, the standard form that we use for entanglement, the entanglement of mn copies of a Bell pair is simply mn. So that gives us this bound. So now what happens is these transformations, 1 and 2, cannot be done perfectly for finite n. So what one does is one allows imperfection, and one requires that the fidelity of these transformations goes to 1 asymptotically in n. So approach unity asymptotically in n. So what exactly do I mean by the fidelity? Suppose you start with an arbitrary bipartite state rho n, and tau n denotes the LOCC operation, which takes you to sigma n. Then all through my talk, you will encounter a quantity fn, f sub n, which is just the fidelity between these two states. Now, what is this state? This is the final state after the entanglement manipulation protocol. It's tau n acting on rho n, and sigma n is the final state or the target state. And that's defined simply as the trace of these two states. And we require, when we say that we want the fidelity to approach 1 asymptotically, what we want is that this quantity fn goes to 1 as n goes to infinity. So the asymptotic entanglement measure of the state rho is then defined by this regularized formula, 1 over n, the e of this rho tensor n. But we had seen in the previous slide that E of rho tensor n satisfied the bound lying between mn and mn prime. This gives us, therefore, upper and lower bounds for this asymptotic entanglement measure. And these upper and lower bounds, this then yield 2 different, in general, asymptotic entanglement measures. So thus, the entanglement manipulation protocol yields 2 different asymptotic entanglement measures for a bipartite state. So the first one is the entanglement cost. That's when you're starting from Bell pairs and going to your target state with asymptotic unit fidelity. And that just comes from this upper bound. Okay. It can be understood as just the minimum number of Bell pairs which are needed to create the state rho, I mean, intuitively. And the other asymptotic entanglement measure is the distillable entanglement. This corresponds to the opposite protocol process of starting from rho tensor n and going to Bell pairs. And it comes from the lower bound, and it is called the distillable entanglement, and can be understood as the maximum number of Bell pairs that can be extracted locally from the state rho. So it gives a measure of the value of the state for any entanglement assisted protocol. Okay, now what do we know? Some things are known. That is, for a bipartite pure state, it is known that the distillable entanglement is equal to the entanglement cost and is given by these 2 quantities, which I'm sure you all know. Here, rho A and rho B are just the reduced density matrices of the system A and B, respectively. And S of rho A just denotes the von Neumann entropy. And they're equal because psi AB is in a pure state by the Schmidt decomposition. So what does this equality tell us, therefore? That locally transforming n copies of the state to n times S rho A copies of a Bell pair is an asymptotically reversible process. So moreover, we know that S of rho A, and which is equal to S of rho B, is the unique asymptotic entanglement measure for psi AB. This is because, as a result by Donald, Michal Horodetsky, and Rudolph, would show that for any other entanglement measure, or to be more mathematically precise, what is called an asymptotically continuous entanglement measure, satisfies these bounds. So if these two are equal, ED is equal to EC, that means the asymptotic entanglement measure is unique. Okay, and that was all as a bit of introduction. And you all know that the practical ability of transforming entanglement from one form to another has many applications. But it is not always justified to assume that the entanglement resource, that is these states that you have, consists of states which are multiple copies or tensor product of a given entangled state. All this while we were considering row tensor then, but there's no reason why Alice and Bob should necessarily share tensor product copies of a given state. So in other words, the entanglement resource need not be memoryless. We associate the word memoryless whenever there's a tensor product structure. So more generally, an entanglement resource is characterized by an arbitrary sequence of bipartite states, which are not necessarily of the tensor product form. So where do these states reside? These sequences of bipartite states are considered to exist in Hilbert spaces of this form, so bipartite Hilbert spaces. And our aim in this talk would be to establish asymptotic entanglement measures for arbitrary sequences of bipartite states. Even though I say arbitrary sequence of bipartite states, in the beginning, or in the major part of this talk, I will actually consider an arbitrary sequence of bipartite pure states. So these are bipartite states. So phi n is actually phi n AB. It's an AB state, and it belongs to this Hilbert space HA tensored HB, whole tensored n. And I'm going to consider these two processes. Starting from this, this is a sequence of pure states, and they're not tensor products of any given pure state, and we want to convert them by LOCC to, say, maximally entangled states of a given rank, MN. So this is my generalized entanglement concentration. I call it concentration because you're starting with pure states and going to maximally entangled pure states. And the reverse, which is entanglement dilution, where we shall consider the opposite direction. Starting from a given set of shared maximally entangled state and ending up with a given set of target states. But of course, we can do it for in the more general scenario where you have a sequence of mixed states, but I leave that result there to the discussion. So for example, this is known, but we will see, hopefully we'll get the time to talk about that as well. So the only assumption, and that's just about the only assumption that we make, is that these underlying Hilbert spaces, HA and HB, are finite dimension. So we are not assuming any other property of these phi n's. So now if rho n, if these rho n's are tensor products of some given state, then, of course, one retrieves the usual memoryless scenario that we discussed all this while. That's the usual known thing. Okay. Now, in order to establish, the idea is to establish the entanglement cost and distillable entanglement in this scenario, right? And in order to do that, I will make use of a method which is called the information spectrum approach. And this method was developed in classical information theory by Verdu and Han. There's actually a beautiful book by them. And it was first extended into quantum information theory by the Japanese Hayashi, Nagaoka, and Ogawa. Now, it is a very powerful method. And it allows us to find the optimal rates of various different protocols, not just entanglement manipulation. I'll talk about this later, what the different protocols are. For example, dense coding, transmission of classical information, private classical capacity, lots of things. So why is the method powerful? Well, the power of the method lies in the fact that it does not rely on any specific nature of the sources or the channels or the entanglement resources which are involved in the protocol. Okay? So the only assumption was that the underlying Hilbert space is a finite dimension. Okay. So, yep.
And using the word classical information theory,
yes,
specified by Verdu and Han, So there's some classical and an analog of
this quantum information spectrum method. It's called the information spectrum method.
Okay.
And it's very analogous, but there are differences arising. So it was originally, so it's normally called the information spectrum approach, and that was developed in classical information theory, and then it was extended to the quantum case, and now it's called the quantum information spectrum approach by the
Jones. Oh, I see.
Is there an analogy of the application, like, is there an analogy of what entanglement of concentration and distillation is?
Not for entanglement, of course, there's no analogy, but for classical information transmission, there is, and for data compression, there is. So for all the protocols which have a classical analog, you can see how closely related they are. But of course, as soon as you go to dense coding or entangle manipulation, you're treading on new ground. But there's a lot to learn from this classical information spectrum approach. So just to set the notation, all of you know what I'm going to say in this slide. But we're going to use spectral projections.
And the only reason for this slide is to tell you what notation I use for it. So the quantum information spectrum approach requires extensive use of spectral projections. So if you have a self-adjoint operator A with such a spectral decomposition, then we denote a spectral projection in this manner. So whenever you see a curly bracket, these braces with A greater than or equal to 0, it just is the projector onto the non-negative eigenspace or the eigenspace spanned by eigenvectors corresponding to non-negative eigenvalues of A. So on the other hand, if you have two operators, A and B, and if you see this A greater than or equal to B, all I mean by it is that it's an orthogonal projection onto the non-negative eigenvalue of this difference operator. And you will also see, similarly, one can define A less than B, which is therefore just II, sum over all I such that lambda I is negative. For A, one can define that way. So we'll use these projectors a lot. Now, let me start with one specific projector, which will play a very important role when we talk about entanglement dilution and entanglement concentration of these two different states. So if you're given a sequence of states, right, then one can define these projectors, P and gamma. Now, what is this projector? It just projects onto all the eigenvalues which are greater than or equal to 2 to the minus n gamma. So it projects onto the eigenspace corresponding to the eigenvalues which are greater than or equal to 2 to the minus n gamma. Now, of course, just to be explicit, if rho n has such a spectral decomposition, so Pn gamma is just this projector. Right? Now, using these, I will define two real-valued quantities. Now, you might say, oh, I'm digressing at this point. The reason, and I'm not really, because the two quantities that I define will turn out to be the entanglement cost and the distillable entanglement of the two processes I'm studying. Oops, sorry, I'm still not good at this. So you see gamma's here. It is gamma, some gamma. So in fact, it would be, can I manipulate these boards? Excuse me, that was too strong. Our boards in Cambridge are really heavy, so you've got to really push them harder. Sorry, I hope I didn't break something. Oh, and this doesn't come down, all right. So Pn gamma is just the projection on rho n greater than or equal to 2 to the minus n gamma in. So right now, you can just treat gamma as the parameter parametrizing this projection operator, okay? Right. Now, using these, I will define two real-valued quantities. In fact, it would be very good to, even though they're there in the slide, let me define them here, if I don't get confused, of course. So we define two different quantities, but you better, let's look at it. So S lower bar rho hat is the supremum of gamma, such that, yes, from the board I'm not writing the lim soups, but it's normally the lim soup, that the trace Pn gamma rho n equal to 1, right? I'm just concentrating on the second one. It's S upper bar, huh? Sorry, is equal to 1. So I'm just concentrating the first one. Okay. So what does this really mean? So the only thing you have to take from here is firstly that if you take gamma to be greater than S upper bar rho hat, then obviously this trace, P n gamma rho n, must go to 1 asymptotically in n, right, as n goes to infinity. So in other words, very naively, what do we understand? So if you have a picture like this, that these are, say, the eigenvalues of rho n, okay? So, and suppose they are the eigenvalues in, say, decreasing order, right? This is just to get an intuitive picture, decreasing order. So this Pn gamma, this projector, projects onto all eigenvalues which are greater than or equal to some value, which is 2 to the minus n gamma. And what it says, therefore, that if you choose all eigenvalues greater than or equal to this for gamma greater than S upper bar rho hat, then these eigenvalues approximately sum to 1, right? So that means with high probability, the eigenvalues would lie in this region. So in other words, for a gamma which is greater than S upper bar rho hat, Pn gamma is nothing else but the orthogonal projection onto the high probability subspace of the operator. So this is just to give you a feeling of what it means. And similarly, if you look at S lower bar rho hat, now you have it out there, so it's the supremum of the same quantity equal to 0. So that obviously, for values of gamma, so this is what we've got to remember, that if you take gamma less than S lower bar rho hat, you must have trace Pn gamma rho n goes to 0. So what does that mean? That for gamma in this range, Pn gamma is a projection onto the complement of the high probability subspace. That means into the low probability subspace. So in other words, if I have a colored chalk, this is the picture. So these are the eigenvalues, well, just schematically speaking. And here is some value 2 to the minus n s upper bar rho hat. Then if you consider these eigenvalues, they will approximately sum to 1. On the other hand, there is another value here, which is, say, 2 to the minus n s lower bar rho hat. And if you sum all values greater than it, then their sum is approximately 0. So with high probability, the values, eigenvalues of rho will actually lie here. That's the meaning of these expressions. But really, the only thing we need for our entire analysis is this fact, that if gamma is greater than S upper bar rho hat, then the trace goes to 1. And for gamma less than this, the trace goes to 0. So we'll just keep that in mind. So what, as I said, the reason for introducing these quantities is because our entanglement cost and our distillable entanglement, as you will see in the course of the talk, is precisely given by these two quantities. But then you will ask, oh, my board's gone. How do you retrieve a board? That's the reason for the hockey stick. All right. Don't worry. I'll just use that board. Yeah. No, I just wanted the result in that board. No, if you could just bring the... Sorry about that. That's good enough. Yeah, so you will ask, we are considering a process. Thank you very much, Jonathan. We are considering a process where phi n is turned to psi mn plus, or psi mn plus is turned to phi n. So what do I mean by saying that the entanglement cost is given by S upper bar rho hat and S lower bar rho hat? So what's the rho in the picture? So as you will see, the rho in the picture is, when I write rho hat, whenever I write a hat, I just mean a sequence of states, okay, n equal to 1 to infinity. So the entanglement cost and the distillable entanglement are given in terms of these quantities, where the rho n's are nothing else but the subsystem states. So you take trace of B of phi n. Okay? So what I mean to say is that the entanglement cost and the distillable entanglement are given by these quantities, where what appears in there are the reduced states. So this is just a summary, so don't worry, I'll explain this in all detail later on. But let me just give you a little more motivation for the nomenclature. As you see, this is the S upper bar and S lower bar. Reminds you a little bit of the von Neumann entropy. And here I call them the inspectral entropy rate and subspectral entropy rate. So why the word entropy rate? Is it related to the von Neumann entropy is the question. And the answer is yes. So you can prove such a bound that the S lower bar is less than equal to S upper bar, and they satisfy such bounds with S of rho n, where rho n are the individual states in the ensemble here. Okay, so that's why the name entropy rate, because see, it looks like an entropy rate. And moreover, if this rho n is indeed given by a tensor product form like this, then it just reduces to the von Neumann entropy of the reduced state. Okay? You can already see, well, oh, let's not jump. I'll come to it in a minute. Okay, now we have all the necessary tools for us in order to discuss the two different processes. So the first process that we'll discuss is entanglement dilution. So this is precisely the picture. Here's Alice and Bob, and they share a sequence of maximally entangled states of rank Mn. Now, I'd like to bring your attention to this Mn. All through the game, this Mn is the variable, and that's the only thing we can manipulate. We can, we have a handle on how big Mn can be. So we have these sequence of shared states, and the aim is to change them via LOCC to a particular sequence of target states, right? So if psi plus Mn is, as I said, the maximally entangled state of rank Mn, and phi n's are target states on that joint Hilbert space, and then it's partially entangled. So it's entanglement dilution, because you're going from maximally entangled to less maximally entangled. So our aim is to then study this process and find what is the optimal rate or the entanglement cost of this process. So how would I define the entanglement cost? So let's see it. I'm giving you definitions without the necessary epsilon and deltas, but just to give you a feeling of it. So this is the process we are considering, right? Transformation from maximally entangled to a given target state. Now, if the fidelity of this LOCC transformation satisfies this thing, that it asymptotically approaches 1, then any real number r, which is greater than or equal to 1 over n log mn, see, this is the same mn, is said to be an achievable rate. This is the usual formula for the rate, right? Log mn by n. And entanglement cost is just defined as the infimum of such rates over all such, infimum of all achievable rates for this class of transformations. And our aim is to find EC for such transformations. So the main first result is this theorem, that the entanglement cost of a sequence of pure bipartite states, so we are really in the, yes, the thing that I haven't completed. So going from psi mn plus to phi n, that's what we're doing. So it's entanglement dilution. So the entanglement cost of a sequence of bipartite pure states is given by S upper bar rho hat, where rho hat is just the sequence of the subsystem states that I talked about. So reduced density matrices of A. Okay, so here, as I said, just to remind you, but we already have it on the board, which is now no longer here, that S upper bar rho hat is given by such a formula. And what I had emphasized on the blackboard before, for gamma greater than S upper bar rho hat, this trace goes to 1, because this was our projector. And therefore, in the eigenspace corresponding to eigenvalues of rho na, which are greater than or equal to 2 to the minus ns upper bar rho hat, is a high probability subspace, exactly what I tried to show in this rough figure. Okay, so let me try to prove this. I'll prove only the direct part. So I'm going to prove that r greater than s upper bar rho hat is achievable, by which I mean that if you choose a rate r greater than s upper bar rho hat, then this fidelity that I defined indeed goes to 1 asymptotically as n goes to infinity. That's the direct part. Okay, so I will only show you that there is an encoding scheme. There is a protocol for which this is true, that fn goes to 1. So let's look at the target state. So the aim is, let's have it here. We want to start from psi plus mn, and we want to go to phi n via LOCC. right? That's the whole idea. So this is my target state. And so let this target state have a Schmidt decomposition of the following form. So what's important is the bit I've written in n. Suppose it has nn non-zero Schmidt coefficients. Okay? And I have ordered the Schmidt coefficients are arranged in decreasing order. So that's the order. Okay? So what's the protocol that I suggest? So Alice, say, has a bipartite system, AA prime. And what she does is she locally prepares this state on AA prime. She has handle over both A and A prime, and she can do that. But that's not the point. The point is that Bob has to share it with Alice, right? So what she does is then she teleports the state of the subsystem A prime to Bob. And that she can do because, remember, they have the shared maximally entangled state. So using her part of the shared maximally entangled state, she can do teleportation. So this is the idea. You have the shared maximally entangled state. Alice locally prepares a bipartite system AA prime in this state, the target state. And oops, what did I do? And then she teleports the A prime part to Bob using the maximally entangled state, right? So the A prime part now goes to Bob. Now, there are, as a result of this teleportation, let the final shared state be denoted by phi tilde mn, right? I put it mn because that's mn plays a Cree role. Mn is the rank of the maximally entangled state that they share originally. Okay? Now, there are two scenarios. Firstly, if mn is greater than or equal to nn. Mn was the rank of the shared maximally entangled state, and nn is the number of non-zero Schmidt coefficients in the target state, right? Now, if mn is greater than or equal to nn, then it's a very simple exercise to see that the teleportation can be done perfectly. And in this case, the final shared state is your desired target state. So this final shared state is just the desired target state. So all I've done is I've replaced A prime by B, because the system A prime is now referred to as B since it is now in Bob's possession. So everything is, there's no worry at all, everything's fine. You ended up with the state you wanted to end up with. And in this case, the fidelity is 1. But of course, that's only one part of the problem. There is the other case, when mn is not greater than or equal to nn. What happens then? Now, if mn is less than nn, then Alice can perfectly teleport only the unnormalized truncated state. So look at, this is the state that she can teleport. Now, see what's happened here. The capital NN, which is the number of non-zero Schmidt coefficients, is now truncated to MN, which is some value which is less than NN. Okay? So only the MN larger Schmidt coefficients of the target state are retained in the teleported state. Now, this is very nice. There have been experiments on this too. This is often referred to as the quantum scissors effect. And it's a trivial exercise to see that this happens. That if the quantum state to be teleported lives in a space of a dimension higher than the rank of the maximally entangled state shared between the two parties, then the higher dimensional terms just get cut off. And that's what you mean by the quantum scissors. So for mn less than mn, the final shared state is then given by this form after the teleportation. This is the truncated state, unnormalized truncated state. And this is some error state, the only reason for it to make this whole thing normalized. Okay? So what happens to the fidelity in this case? Now, using Ullmann's theorem, we want to find fn, which is the fidelity between the desired target state and this final state after the protocol. So this is the final state, and that's the target state. And what you can show very easily is that it's just given in terms of the overlap between the desired target state and this truncated state. So what is this? Remember, this has capital NN Schmidt coefficients. This is just the same state, but truncated to MN Schmidt coefficients. Therefore, you can very easily see that you can write it as trace of a projection operator times rho n. What is the Q? Q just projects onto the MN largest eigenvalues of the reduced matrix. Now, this is very clear. Why? Because the Schmidt coefficients are just eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. right? So we find that Fn is, so I'll just summarize what I got in the last slide, that if you have Mn, which is the rank of the maximally entangled state, to be less than the total number of non-zero Schmidt coefficient, then what we find from the previous slide is that the age bar goes lower and lower for people doing quantum information, isn't it? That Fn is greater than or equal to trace of a projector times the reduced density matrix. So Q is the orthogonal projection onto the Mn largest eigenvalues of the reduced state. Okay? But that's not good enough. We want to show that the fidelity goes to 1. And how will we show that? So this is the claim that I make, that by choosing Mn appropriately, remember Mn is the only tool that we can tamper with. So by choosing Mn appropriately, we can ensure that Fn does go to 1 as n goes to infinity. So my claim is that in spite of the truncation of the state under teleportation, so we under teleportation, the phi n state got truncated to phi tilde Mn state. It only retained the Mn eigenvalues. In spite of this truncation, you can achieve unit fidelity asymptotically if you suitably choose Mn. That's the message I want to get across. And the question is now, how would you do that? So once again, these wonderful projection operators that we introduced here, and out there too, yes, probably somewhere there, come to our rescue. So now consider the projection operator, which projects onto the eigenvalues, which are greater than or equal to 2 to the minus n gamma. But the states involved are the reduced states. Okay? So it's very easy to see, just a simple exercise, that the rank of this, which will play a crucial role, satisfies this upper bound. In fact, let us see how it happens. Why is this so? So obviously, if you look at this trace of this projection operator times this difference operator, that must be non-negative. Why? Because Pn gamma is just the projection onto the non-negative eigenspace of this difference operator. Okay? And from there, it's just two lines. You just move things around and use that trace P rho is upper bounded by trace rho, which is 1, which will give you this quantity. So it's just simple algebraic details. But the thing to remember is that trace of Pn gamma has this upper bound. Okay, you'll see in a minute why that plays a very crucial role. But just to again remind you that this is the very same projection operator that arose in the definition of our S upper bar and S lower bar quantities. So the only thing, two things to take along from this slide is firstly this upper bound on the rank of this projection operator, and secondly is the fact that we have encircled here, that is, if you choose a gamma, the parameter to be greater than S upper bar rho hat, then we have that the trace goes to 1. Okay, so this slide seemed to not quite connect with what I was saying before. Let me draw the connections now, and you'll see why it's this slide was essential. In the previous slide, we had found that if you choose Mn to be less than Nn, right, that's the whole thing we are worried about, because if Mn is greater than or equal to Nn, there was no problem. So if you had this scenario, then we found that this was true, that the fidelity satisfied this lower bound. Now, we want to prove that the fidelity goes to 1 asymptotically. So how can we do that? We can do that by showing that this trace Q rho is greater than trace P rho, with gamma greater than S upper bar rho hat. Now, is that clear why? That's because we just saw that for such a gamma, trace P rho will go to 1. So if we prove that we have proved that Fn is greater than this, now if this is greater than that, and this goes to 1, then obviously the fidelity goes to 1. So that's the line of argument. By the way, just interrupt and ask if there's any questions at all. So now the question is, how can we choose Mn? See, the only thing that we can play around with is Mn. So can we choose Mn appropriately so that this is true? Because if this is true, we are done. Then the fidelity does go to 1. Okay. So to do that, we shall consider once again the eigenvalues of rho and a in decreasing order. And let's see whether schematically we can at least understand how this can be achieved. So I've done two things. I've just depicted the eigenvalues of rho A in decreasing order. Of course, they need not be equally spaced. And I'm just going to see what's the action of this Q. Remember, Q just projects onto the first or the largest Mn eigenvalues. Now, I've arranged them in decreasing order, and if I've labeled them 1 to Mn, it will project onto the subspace corresponding to these eigenvalues. Now, what is the other project in the game? Because remember, our whole idea is to prove this, that trace Q rho, this is Q Mn, and these are all rho n A's, is greater than equal to trace P n gamma rho n A. Right? That's our idea. So that's why I'm looking at this projector and this projector. So the first projector projects onto all eigenvalues up to the mnth eigenvalue, and the second projector projects onto all eigenvalues greater than equal to 2 to the minus n gamma, because that was our projector, right? P n gamma was just the projector onto the all eigenvalues greater than equal to 2 to the minus n gamma. But you know, just from the previous slide, we found that the trace P n gamma is upper bounded by 2 to the n gamma. So the question is, how many such blue eigenvalues are there? There must be at most 2 to the n gamma eigenvalues, right? Because of this relation. So now can we prove such a bound by suitably choosing Mn? Yes, we can prove such a bound. As long this bound would be true as long as you choose Mn to be greater than 2 to the n gamma. Because then trace Q of rho would be obviously greater than equal to trace P of rho. Because this projects onto larger number of eigenvalues than trace P. And in that case, we will achieve what we wanted to achieve, that the fidelity, this we got already, is greater than equal to trace Q rho, is it now greater than trace P rho. And then we are done, because if you choose gamma to be greater than S upper bar rho hat, we have it up here on the board, then we know that this trace goes to 1. And therefore, the fidelity will go to 1. So just to finish up the details with this protocol then, if the rank Mn of the initial shared state is chosen to be, for example, the ceiling of 2 to the n gamma, where gamma is some number which is greater than S upper bar rho hat, then the fidelity goes to 1. So hence a rate, which is 1 over n log Mn, greater than gamma, greater than S upper bar rho hat, is indeed achievable. And that's precisely what I wanted to prove. Okay. The proof in the other direction is a little more technical. I wouldn't go into it, but we can also prove the weak converse, that if you choose a rate less than S upper rho hat, then it is not achievable. So putting these together, we get our first result that was claimed in the first theorem, that the entanglement cost is given by S upper bar rho hat. Now, I've done quite a few steps in the protocol. So just to summarize it, I have the slide. So what we are wanting to do, this is just a summary, is to go from maximally entangled state shared between Alice and Bob to these fixed target states, where these target states have such a Schmidt decomposition with nn non-zero coefficients. So the protocol is that Alice locally prepares a prime, a bipartite system in her control in this target state, and then she teleports a prime to Bob. Now, if Mn is greater than or equal to Nn, then the fidelity is 1, there's no problem. If Mn is less than Nn, then there is a truncation, but even then, the fidelity goes to 1 if we choose Mn appropriately. More precisely, if we choose it like this. Okay. Now for the other process, which is the asymptotic entanglement concentration of pure states. So this is when we start with a given set of states and we want to go to maximally entangled states. So these are partially entangled state. So our aim is to find the optimal protocol for optimal rate for this protocol. So what is the distillable entanglement? How is it defined? It's exactly analogous to the entanglement cost. The fidelity of the LOCC transformation, if it goes to 1, then any real number r less than equal to log mn by n is said to be an achievable rate. And the distillable entanglement is simply the supremum of this rate. Now, the result was originally found by Hayashi. All we did was simplify the converse. But anyway, it's going. Let me state it anyway. So for the entanglement concentration protocol, going from the phi n to this, the distillable entanglement is the other S that we had here. So here, once again, the rho n's are just the reduced states. So the protocol here is very different. So let's see. So once again, the shared initial state is now phi n, right? Because now we are going the other way around from the phi n's by LOCC to the psi mn plus, right? And now, once again, look at the projection operator that I've defined and the projection onto its, the complement, which is less than. So this is the projection operator, again, defined in used in the definition of S upper bar rho hat. And the only thing that we are going to make use of, this is the only important step, that if you take gamma to be less than S lower bar rho hat, this is what we had on the board, then trace of P rho goes to zero. And obviously trace of P upper bar, P the complement of rho must go to one. So these are the only things that we'll need. So this is the protocol. Alice and Bob initially share this state. So the protocol is that Alice does a von Neumann measurement corresponding to these two projections on her part of the shared state. Now, if the outcome corresponds to Pn gamma, then we say it's a failure, and the protocol is aborted. Remember, what is the probability of this failure? It's trace P rho, right? That's what we know from measurement theory. And already, let me give you an indication of where I'm going. If you choose gamma less than S upper bar rho hat, then trace P rho goes to zero. So what we are going to show, finally, is that the probability of this failure is asymptotically goes to zero. Now, if on the other hand, the outcome corresponds to Pn gamma bar, that's the complement, then we say it's a success. Now, I haven't told you yet what I mean by the success, but let me just say that the probability of going down this branch is trace Pn bar gamma, right? And obviously, if trace P rho goes to zero, then that would imply trace P bar rho must go to one. So all I'm trying to do is to motivate you to think that the probability of failure would go to zero, and this would go to one if you choose gamma appropriately. So if the outcome corresponds to, if there is a success, right? That means that the outcome corresponds to this P bar gamma. Then what is the post-measurement state? So the post-measurement state must be proportional to this operator, this state, right? Because this is the projection operator on A's part, and nothing's being done on B's part because this was the local measurement done by Alice. So what is this? What is this P upper bar, so the P bar n gamma, that was just a projection onto all eigenvalues of rho n, which were less than 2 to the minus n gamma, okay? So this state must be just the truncated state. Now only the eigenvalues which are less than 2 to the minus n gamma are retained. Now, this is because this was the expression for P bar. So now we want a normalized state, so all we do is normalize it. So don't worry about this, this is just a normalized factor. So this is the final state if Alice's measurement is successful. But because it's a normalized state, so this is nothing else but a Schmidt decomposition of this final state. 5 or 10? Could I? All right, not too far from the end anyway. So then you see these are nothing else but the square root of the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix because they are the Schmidt coefficients. Is the clock wrong or do you stop 5 minutes early? Okay, all right. So each eigenvalue is bounded by 2 to the minus n gamma of this. So Alice's measurement, if successful, well, I'll go through this a bit quickly then. Then it takes us from the state phi n to the state psi n, right? But we wanted to go from phi n to psi plus mn, right? That was our whole aim. And the question is there an LOCC operation that will indeed do so? So we've come from phi n to psi n, and now can we go to psi plus mn? And the answer, I will skip the details, is yes, if you choose Mn appropriately. That is, once again, by Nielsen's, using Nielsen's majorization theorem. So I can tell you the details to anybody who's interested later on, but I'll skip this slide. and just go, if you choose Mn to be given by such an expression, then we already saw if you choose gamma less than S lower bar, then the probability of failure goes to 0, and the probability of success goes to 1. And a rate less than S lower bar is indeed achievable. And the weak converse shows that the rate greater than S lower bar is not achievable. Putting the two and two together, we find the distillable entanglement is indeed S lower bar rho hat. So this is the summary. If you start with these non-maximally entangled state and you want to go over to these maximally entangled states, that's entanglement concentration, the protocol is that Alice does a von Neumann measurement corresponding to these two projectors on her part of the shared state. If the outcome corresponds to P, she says it's failure. And if outcome corresponds to P bar, she says it's a success. And in this case, we saw that you could go from phi to some intermediate state psi. Then the bit I didn't show is that if you choose gamma to be less than this, and you choose Mn appropriately, then by LOCC, you could actually arrive at your desired maximally entangled state. So this is just a quick summary. So entanglement dilution, this is the entanglement cost. On the other side, if you do entanglement concentration, this is the distillable entanglement. But an interesting point. There are sequences of states for which S lower bar is equal to S upper bar, and which then is equal to this quantity. And these are sequences of states which are said to be information stable. So what do you get for such sequences of states? EC, which was equal to this, and ED, which was equal to this, are therefore equal. And you have a unique asymptotic entanglement measure. And this is, for example, the case when the sequence of states is a tensor product of a given state. And in this case, the rho hats, which is the subsequent states, are also tensor products. And you retrieve the known result that there is a unique entanglement measure given by the von Neumann entropy of the reduced state. But there are sequences for which this is not true. S lower bar is not equal to S upper bar. For example, there are states, sequences of states, for which the reduced states are convex combinations of this form. In this particular case, you can prove that ED is less than EC. So the conclusion would be that the asymptotic entanglement measure is unique only for information stable sequences. Now, one very interesting fact is that, this is just a concluding slide, that this S lower bar and the S upper bar can be derived from two different quantities, which are defined in a very similar way. So I won't go into their detailed definitions. But what is nice is, here rho hat is a sequence of states, omega hat is a sequence of positive operators. And all you know is that by suitable substitutions of omega hat, we get S lower bar and S upper bar. So here all I'm doing is substituting for omega hat just the sequence of identity operators. So you see, these are called the divergence rates, and it can be just considered as a generalization of the quantum relative entropy. Because for the quantum relative entropy too, if you put S rho I, then you get the von Neumann entropy. And not only that, you can get the conditional entropy for this substitution, you can get the mutual information if you put a rho A here. Just as you do there, from these Ds, you get a sequence of von Neumann entropy, spectral entropy rates, conditional entropies, and mutual information rates. And the nice thing is, these are mathematically very beautiful quantities, which satisfy a whole set of very rich inequalities. Araki leaves strong subadditivity, etc., chain rule inequalities. But not only are they mathematically well defined, they all have operational meanings. For example, if you consider a conditional entropy rate, you will find that's the entanglement manipulation when you do not just pure states, but mixed states is given in terms of a conditional. The mutual corresponds to the classical information transmission capacity. So all these generalized spectral entropy rates and conditional rates, therefore, allow you to study all these protocols in all generality without any assumption of memoryless or anything of the sort, or ergodicity or anything of the sort. So the quantum information spectrum, therefore, provides a unifying mathematical framework for evaluating the optimal rates of various information theoretic tasks For example, S lower bar and S upper bar gives the data compression rate. And there are a whole plethora of open problems. For example, use it to find the quantum capacity. We feel we're almost there, but we can only prove one direction. And distributed quantum compression and quantum capacity in the presence of feedback, and Slepian and Wolf, or anything else you can think about. Thank you very much.
You have these sets of states. You're moving from a set of tensor products of identical copies of the states to general collections of states.
Yes.
So you have this situation where, in a sense, if I have a set of states and I add a particular extra state to it, it's going to affect the...
You're talking about compatibility.
Yeah,
right. That's a very relevant question, but the compatibility is satisfied when we consider these row ends, which are general mixed states. So the fact is, you just can consider any arbitrary, so there need not be any relation at all between the row ends and the next row end bar.
Sure. Well, I was thinking, it's a kind of contextuality. Mm-hmm. Inherent in this, so it's not properties that work in the entangled measure of a given state.
Yeah.
Because its effect on.
No, but I'm not saying the entangled
measure of a
right.
State.
Because I'm not saying the entangled measure of a given state. Because you can only talk about entangled measure of a given state if you take density product copies of it. So I'm generalizing the concept to an entangled measure of an arbitrary sequence of states. But as a result of the general theory is that we could then find the entanglement measures in the case when, for example, it's not tensor products of a given state, but convex combination of tensor products, which is already a very hard problem to do, and I know of no other way to do it.
Is it impossible for there to be any entanglement measure that I can apply to given states such that it wasn't contextual in this sense, such that a given state didn't contribute differently to disentangled measure applied to a set of states?
The state sequence you're considering is just a special case of this sequence, right? Because you're just putting an additional condition that there is, if you consider rho n to n plus 1, if you take partial trace, you get back the rho n, right? That's the only additional condition that you're given. Am I understanding you correctly? What I can assure you is that everything that is mathematically well defined, but it is defined as the Italian measure of a sequence of states. And this, to our mind, is the only state we generalize beyond taking dense product. But the interesting thing is very likely to see how you can use this result to get particular results for examples where it's not so arbitrary, where you put some conditions, for example, when it's convex combination of dense products. And the nice thing is that you can get explicit expressions in terms of entropic quantities. For example, what you can get is that the data compression rate is given by S upper bar rho hat. Now here rho hat is the sequence of states rho n. And remember, quantum information source is in general defined by a sequence of states acting on Hilbert spaces. And the data compression limit is given by S upper bar rho. Now what about the source? Suppose you have a source where each rho n is, say, t times omega tensor n plus 1 minus t times, say, mu tensor n. What can you say about the data compression limit here? And now I'm going to make a mistake, but you can prove that in this case, the optimal rate of data compression, call that r, is given by the minimum of S, the von Neumann entropy of omega, and S of mu minimum. So do you see the power of the result there? Because I wouldn't be able to do this in general by the memory things we use, like Schumacher compression. You can't do it because it's not memoryless. But using this result, then you can boil it down to what is the result in terms of the individual polynomial entropies of these composite states. So this is one example where it's very powerful.
Do you have an idea of how generally the two quantities would not be equal? Entanglement, concentration, and isolation.
Yeah, it's.
Can you use the way you construct to find cases where the so-called bound entangled state occurs?
We haven't looked at bound entanglement, I must say. But the norm is that they don't agree. Rather, generally, they only agree if they satisfy this condition of information state. And I've given you one example where there's this convex combination where it doesn't agree. And another very interesting thing which you can do, and I don't know the answer to the bound entanglement question just because I haven't looked at it yet, but what you can also find is, let me give you a simple example, is that normally when we find an optimal rate of something, for example, data compression, because it's simplest to talk about that, then you find that the optimal rate is the Born-Neumann entropy, right? So if you choose a rate greater than S rho, then the fidelity or the error probability of making an error in decompressing goes to zero. And if we take a rate less than S rho, then the probability of error goes to one. But in these more general, that's for memory-less sources. As soon as we talk about not information stable situation, not memory-less, what arises is a second rate. You get a rate here, and you get another rate here. This is called the Strom-Converse rate. Here the probability of error goes to zero, and here the probability of error goes to one. In fact, so there is a separation between the two, which is also very interesting from this information theoretic point of view. Yeah?
So there are other examples that are, let's say, physically interesting. I think that you can always build a mathematical example of a stable source. But can you think of something?
Ergodic sources would be stable, information stable. So one can. Also, if you have quantum information source, where the states are given by Gibbs states, that's also information stable. So you can come up with examples. Yeah? But if you consider all generality, then they're not. Yeah?
Can you come in a multi-complex scenario?
I mean, it sounds simple. This is hard enough. No, I would be very happy to do that. It's already what I haven't told you is what happens when you consider, you just stop me when you want me to stop. All right. Because there are quite a few results, but I'm just trying to tell you that even this particular case, when you're starting from Alice and Bob sharing a sequence of maximally entangled state, and you want to generate a sequence of mixed states, right? And you could do 1 to infinity. This was already fun enough, and here you find the entanglement cost, funnily enough, is related to the conditional. And it's very, the argument, for those who are interested, they can tell me later on. I have not told you what A and R are, but it is related to conditional entropy. And it is very nice to see how the conditional entropy appears by relating the entanglement cost to the entanglement formation. You stood up, so good to stop. Thank you very much.